From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Yanukovych again insists he is Ukraine's real president. The Syrian war takes a devastating toll on children. Rising violence in Iraq is raised at a U.S. State Department briefing. And 1 billion people reportedly at risk of extreme poverty.
Once you've escaped poverty, you need to keep on in an upward trajectory. You need to keep on moving away from poverty because you can easily fall back in again.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych read a brief statement on the crisis in Ukraine today in his second public appearance since fleeing to Russia in late February. Michael Eccles has details from Moscow.
The massive click-clack sound from press photographers forced a smile on Viktor Yanukovych as he entered the conference hall. 8 minutes later, the ousted president turned and left, taking no questions. In the interim, he made his case.
В стране действует банда ультранационалистов и неофашистов.
A group of ultranationalists and neo-fascists is at work in Ukraine to put the country's army under the banner of Bandera and start a civil war, Mr. Yanukovych said. Stepan Bandera was a highly controversial World War II-era Ukrainian nationalist leader with ties to the Nazis. Mr. Yanukovych criticized the United States for promising monetary aid to Ukraine's new government.
Я намерен обратиться в Конгресс, в Сенат и в Верховный суд.
He said he would appeal to the U.S. Congress, Senate, and Supreme Court to assess the legality of giving such aid, insisting that U.S. laws prohibit it from giving money to what he called bandits.
Остаюсь не только единственным легитимным президентом Украины, но и верховным главнокомандующим.
Mr. Yanukovych also insisted that he remains Ukraine's only legitimate president and its commander-in-chief, and that he would soon return to Kyiv. However, given that Mr. Yanukovych has been dismissed as a political corpse by Russian President Vladimir Putin, and that in Ukraine there is a warrant for his arrest on charges of mass murder, it is unclear what sway the ousted president has in the ongoing crisis. Michael Eccles, Voice of America, Moscow, Russia.
Ukrainian Interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk is set to meet Wednesday at the White House with President Obama. White House spokesperson Jay Carney spoke Monday about U.S. efforts to get an international consensus on what's happening in Ukraine.
We have been working with our partners to make clear to the Russians that there is an avenue available to them that would allow for an international effort to monitor and ensure that the rights of all Ukrainians are protected, including ethnic Russians, and that therefore, any reasoning that their military intervention was necessary to protect the rights of ethnic Russians becomes defunct, as if it were ever, even if it were ever valid.
The U.S. State Department Monday called on Russia to show evidence is ready to engage on U.S. diplomatic proposals to end the crisis in Crimea. Ukraine's intelligence chiefs recommended against signing a 1994 landmark international agreement to swap thousands of nuclear weapons for promises from Russia to observe Ukrainian independence. That from reporter Jamie Detmer from Kiev.
The former head of Ukraine's external intelligence service, Mykola Mamush, says Ukrainian security chiefs feared Russia would eventually try to seize Crimea and urged the country's then-president, Leonid Kuchma, to demand an enforcement mechanism for the 1994 Budapest Memorandum before signing it.
Ні, такого не було. Спецслужби якраз працювали на те, щоб ці угоди підписували.
He says intelligence chiefs worried that the agreement signed by the U.S., Russia, Britain and Ukraine failed to provide legally binding assurances. The Western powers in Ukraine say Russia has broken the agreement by invading Crimea. The Budapest Memorandum committed all parties to refrain from the threat or use of force against Ukraine's territorial integrity. But the agreement is not a treaty and doesn't require any of the signatories to do anything in the event of violations. Malmush, an army general who's advising Ukraine's interim government, says he and other Ukrainian security and military chiefs have been talking behind the scenes with their Russian counterparts since Russia seized Crimea to find a way to resolve the crisis.
Зараз мужність і позиція української армії
And he says Ukrainian forces are being moved to the east of the country to deter any further aggression from Russia. Ukrainian forces will continue to show restraint and only fight if there are further Russian encroachments into Ukraine or if the lives of soldiers are threatened. But the slow deployment of Ukrainian forces has earned the reproof of the leaders of the Maidan uprising. One of them, Sergei Pyakov, says the interim government has been too slow in response to Russia's land grab of Crimea.
It seems like they have behaved very passively to the situation. We don't understand why they are really not doing anything, you know, decisive.
While not calling for a firefight, Pyakov and other leaders of the uprising that ousted President Viktor Yanukovych last month believe Ukraine's interim government...
They could block the approach to the Crimea and even the part of the Crimea with our own army. We could stay the like a line of defense about, you know, the half of the Crimea.
With a referendum of Crimea's future just days away, the tension is mounting. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
There is another aspect of Ukrainian life which has an impact on what's happening in that region. Many Ukrainians are members of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is part of the Russian Orthodox Church, and Orthodox priests have been seen among the protesters and the Russian troops in Crimea. For some understanding of Orthodoxy and how it is associated with the governments of the nations in which it exists, BOA's Doug Bernard spoke with Marian Simeon, assistant director of the Boston Theological Institute and an Orthodoxy scholar. He said Orthodoxy almost always exists in a dependent relationship with a host government.
Faith leaders are political leaders in many ways, and they make decisions based on the rational choice model to increase their popularity or their power or their authority or to maintain it.
Is this in some ways why we're seeing images, for example, Russian troops or Russian leaning paramilitaries serving stationed in Crimea, and yet very close by are Russian Orthodox priests offering blessings and, you know, singing psalms, that sort of thing?
Yes, because the church, unfortunately, in Russia and not only, has become the resonance box of the state. And whatever the state wishes, the church cannot completely contradict it. We've seen a similar situation during the war between Georgia and Russia, when initially the leaders of the church, both in Georgia and Russia, which are both Orthodox countries predominantly, they were trying to mediate the conflict only to go back to nationalistic stereotypes within a matter of 2 or 3 days. And we see the same thing happening in Ukraine versus Russia. Also, something else that is happening, there are groups of Bulgarians and Serbs forming to go with the purpose of going to Crimea to defend their nation, which is under attack. So it gets very complex, but just for the listeners to understand, it is a loyalty test that faith communities have to take. So the loyalty, unfortunately, seems to be primarily to the nation rather than to the church.
In some forms of various religions, some forms of Christianity, some forms of Islam and elsewhere, there's a sense that no matter where you are part of the brotherhood, to use that term, of X faith. Is that true in Orthodoxy? Because what you're describing sounds more like a compartmentalized sense of identity.
Absolutely. Orthodox Christianity teaches that is a universalistic faith that goes beyond localities and ethnicities. So that is in theory. In practice, when we deal with situations of violence, it becomes very parochial. It makes decisions that are momentum-driven and which obviously contradict the teachings. We have many, many cases of heresies. We have cases in which religious symbols have been used by the state with the complicity of the church itself to justify certain actions.
Marion Simeon is assistant director of the Boston Theological Institute and an Orthodoxy scholar.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
A new report by the UN Children's Fund describes the devastating impact on the lives of Syria's children as the civil war in their country enters its fourth year. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund says the last year has been the worst for Syrian children. During the past 12 months, it says the number of children affected by conflict has more than doubled to 5.5 million inside and outside Syria. Among the hardest hit, it says, are 1 million children living under siege and in hard-to-reach areas in Syria. As of January, UNICEF reports violence has killed more than 10,000 children in Syria. It says children often are not accidental victims of war, but are deliberately targeted. Witnesses report children and infants have been killed by snipers or become victims of summary executions or torture. Schools have been bombed. The report notes 1.2 million refugee children living in camps and host communities in neighboring countries also suffer from the war. They have limited access to clean water, nutritious food, or opportunities for education. UNICEF says thousands of Syrian refugee children have to work to support their destitute families, and many girls are forced into early marriage. UNICEF's Middle East and North Africa Regional Chief of Communication, Simon Ingram, says many Syrian internally displaced and refugee children are suffering profound emotional and psychological distress from the war.
And here we're talking about the hidden injuries, the hidden wounds that have been inflicted on children because of what they've experienced. The behavioral changes, the nightmares that they carry around with them, the way in which they can no longer function as normal children do. And this is an aspect of the crisis which has been too often overlooked, but which is growing all the time.
UNICEF estimates 2 million children are in need of psychological support or treatment. Ingram says millions of Syrian children are missing out on education. He warns the impact of this on the lives of a whole generation and for the future of their country cannot be underestimated.
And all of these number of children are out of school, therefore have none of the skills that will be needed ever in the future to put this country back on its feet. That's the longer picture that we have to focus on, the fact that sooner or later this conflict will end and a new generation will have to be on hand and ready and prepared with the skills and the belief and the drive to reconstitute a new Syria of the future. And what we're seeing at the moment is that that whole generation on which that responsibility would fall are actually not in a position to do that.
UNICEF is calling for the international community to use its influence to end the war, to make it possible for aid agencies to get access to 1 million hard-to-reach children in Syria, to protect children from exploitation and harm, and to invest in children's education. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The deadly weekend suicide car bombing at a security checkpoint in southern Iraq and ongoing tensions in the region between Iraq and its neighbors were among the subjects reporters brought up at the Monday U.S. State Department media briefing. Here is spokesperson Jennifer Saki.
Iraq has made significant progress in improving relations with some countries in the region, such as Kuwait and Jordan, but progress with others has been limited. We continue to encourage improved ties between Iraq and its Arab neighbors, particularly the GCC. The situation in Syria has certainly fueled tensions in the region, and foreign fighters are making their way into Iraq from Syria. We are particularly concerned, of course, about this. We share Iraq's concern over the levels of violence, and we are working with the Iraqis to implement a holistic strategy.
Iraq has seen a spike in violence since last April, when the death toll climbing to its highest level since the worst of the country's sectarian bloodletting in 2006 to 2008. The UN says more than 8,800 people were killed in 2013 and more than 1,400 people were killed in January and February of this year.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Climbing out of extreme poverty and staying there can be very difficult. A new report warns up to 1 billion people are at risk of extreme poverty by 2030 unless more is done to support them in hard times. VOA's Joe DiCapua has details.
Unemployment, poor health, high food prices, conflict, and natural disasters. These are some of the things that can drive people below the poverty line of $1.25 a day. The Overseas Development Institute and the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network have released the third Chronic Poverty Report. Network Director Andrew Shepherd, the lead author, warns of poverty's revolving door.
People fall into poverty as well as escape it, and once they've escaped it, they can fall back in again.
He says there are three legs of poverty that must be addressed.
You can be poor the whole of your life, chronically poor, and policies, generally speaking, don't deal very well with that. You can become poor, you can be impoverished. Policies are beginning to address that a little bit better than they did 10 years ago, but there's still a long way to go on that, especially in Africa and actually also in Asia. And then once you've escaped poverty, you need to keep on in an upward trajectory. You need to keep on moving away from poverty because you can easily fall back in again.
It's estimated there were 1.2 billion people in extreme poverty in 2010. That's a decline of 700 million since 1990. Shepherd says that's good news, but the trend may not continue.
People who are chronically poor, they're poor over their lifetimes for reasons, and those reasons can be quite hard to tackle. For example, they might be discriminated against. And some countries now have good policies against discrimination, but many countries don't yet, or they don't implement them.
Shepherd says the most frequent cause for falling back below the poverty line is ill health. The report recommends three approaches to what it calls zero poverty.
The first of these is providing some sort of cash relief, if you like, cash transfers or an employment guarantee, something which provides a safety net. The second thing is a massive investment in education, because education works to help people out of poverty, to keep them going in the right direction. And education, of course, works to sustain people's escapes out of poverty, provided that you can get them up to a high enough level.
Primary and secondary education levels are a must, he says. The third step to reduce poverty is called pro-poorest economic growth.
You need jobs, of course. And those jobs can be agricultural, non-agricultural. But jobs also need to be decent. They need to pay some kind of minimum wage. That can be underpinned by an employment guarantee. And you need health and safety provisions.
The report calls on all countries to have universal health coverage and good disaster risk management to deal with the weather extremes of climate change. It also says international aid will continue to be extremely important in low-income countries. However, it adds, few donors have displayed real interest in tackling chronic poverty.
The report does an analysis which shows that there are about 44 countries who spend a total of less than $500 per person per year. That's on everything. And the report also indicates that quite a few of those countries, I think it was 19, won't be doing very much better by 2030.
Shepherd says countries also can find more money to help tackle poverty by doing a better job of collecting taxes. He says some of the success stories in reducing poverty in recent years include China, Vietnam, Brazil, Ethiopia, Nepal, and Bangladesh. The issue of chronic poverty is expected to be addressed as the international community decides how to replace the Millennium Development Goals, They come due next year. Last October, the World Bank reported the number of people living in extreme poverty had declined sharply in the past three decades. But it warned about 400 million children continue to live in what it called abysmal conditions. Bank President Jim Yong Kim said the goal of ending poverty and boosting shared prosperity can be achieved, but only if nations work together with new urgency. Those efforts, he said, must include education and health care for children. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It's been a year since Benedict XVI became the first pope in centuries to resign amid allegations of scandal and mismanagement at the Vatican, and was replaced by the first pontiff from the Americas. In this report for VOA Television, religion reporter Jerome Sokolowski reports on the hopes that Pope Francis would bring major changes in the church.
A church built on such solid pillars can only be shaken up, it might seem, by a Superman, which is how one artist in Rome depicted the current pope. But it's a mistake to think that a single individual can transform this 2,000-year-old institution, says American Jesuit scholar John Conley.
I don't believe in the great man theory of history, that one person suddenly appears and without any reference to all the other forces going on can sort of turn things around.
But this baby-kissing pontiff has brought huge crowds to St. Peter's Square, and he is getting traditional Catholics to break out of their comfort zone, says Conley.
I think he is calling the church to follow what he's doing as pope, what he did as archbishop, to get onto the bus, get out into the marketplace, pick up the microphone, get your picket line ready to go.
The pope has showed himself to be an advocate of the poor, says John Carr, a former advisor to the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference. Carr has led discussions at Georgetown University in Washington on the new pope and recalls a comment by former Republican presidential advisor Michael Gerson.
He says, I think your new pope is a troublemaker. And he said, there's nothing more dangerous
than a troublemaker with a plan. And this is 220 pages of plan.
The Pope's 220-page exhortation, presented last fall at a Vatican news conference, said that not sharing with the poor is stealing. It angered free market advocates.
This is just pure Marxism.
Returning from his first foreign trip, Francis spoke compassionately about homosexuality.
If a person is gay and seeks God and has goodwill, who am I to judge him?
He's also taken steps to rein in the Vatican Bank and appoint more non-European cardinals.
Jesus,
but don't expect Francis to accept female clergy or artificial birth control, says Carr.
I think if people are expecting him to sort of reverse decades of teaching, I think they'll be very disappointed.
He concedes that much of what Francis has brought is a change of style. But style can be as important as substance in a church that loves symbolism. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
Eight days and 13 hours after he began, the winner has crossed the finish line in the nearly 1,500-kilometer Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Picking up his second win, Dallas Seavey drove his dog sled across the finish line early today in Nome, Alaska. He came from behind to pass four-time race winner Jeff King and second-place finisher Ali Zirkel in the last 124 kilometers. Seavey became the youngest Iditarod champion when he won the 2012 race at age 25. He comes from a family of mushers, as the sled drivers are called. Seavey's grandfather helped organize the first race in 1973, and his father won last year and in 2006. The Iditarod race from just outside Anchorage to Nome was marked by poor conditions because of a lack of snow due to a warm winter. The race began March 2nd in the town of Willow with 69 teams. By Monday, 15 mushers had dropped out. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.